All right, welcome to the show. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, as usual, okay? And we have a packed show for you today, so I'm going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with two students from UC Santa Cruz, from the University of California, Santa Cruz. That's Ethan Pizzolo and Laurie Nixon. And these are two students who are part of the Highway 6, and we'll find out more about what they did at the back end of the show. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix. Carl is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And I want to let you know that we talked with Carl shortly before the decision came down to exonerate the cop who brutally murdered two black people, a man and a woman, in Cleveland, Ohio. And that outrageous decision to let this cop go scot-free when everyone is aware of the fact that the police shot 137 bullets into the car itself, and this man jumped up on the hood of the car, firing like he was like John Wayne or something, firing into the windshield and just blowing these two people away, two unarmed black people, a man and a woman. So this decision came down after I spoke with Carl, and more than anything else, it backs up everything that Carl is saying in this interview. We're talking with Carl about the stakes, the tremendously high stakes for the people and for the system in the struggle today around police brutality and police murder. And recently, there was an article in RevCom.us and in Revolution Newspaper that began like this. The struggle for justice for Freddie Gray began when someone videotaped the murderous assault of the Baltimore police on a young man innocent of any crime. It gained momentum as people went into the streets day after day, and it hit a high point in the rebellion of April 27th. This rebellion, and then the way in which many other sections of society refused to stop fighting for justice even after the rebellion was slandered and violently suppressed, forced the powers that be to file charges. And that's pretty much where things stand today in a nutshell. But joining us to talk about what's really going on here, what are the stakes involved in all this, and why people need to keep focused on this and acting around it is Carl Dix. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Well, let's jump right into this because, to me, this is one of the things, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot, about the need for people to really, you know, dig into this to understand what's going on here. Let's begin with the basic question. What makes Baltimore, the rebellion and the uprising in Baltimore, what makes it different than anything else?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things that make it different, but at the heart of it is that people stood up in a very powerful way and delivered a clear message that this will not be tolerated, and this being that police have a green light to brutalize and murder black, in Baltimore it's black people because Baltimore is a majority black city, but black and Latino people all across the country. People in Baltimore stood up and said, no, this must stop. And they did it in a very determined way. And in saying that, I am speaking to all of the different ways that people stood up. It was all part of delivering this powerful message. And what makes that very important for people to look at is that there's really high stakes on both sides of this battle. There's very sky-high stakes for the rulers of this country who have to have their police out there enforcing this brutality, carrying out murder, spreading terror in these oppressed communities, because these are communities where they have no answer for the misery, the poverty, and the degradation that people are forced to endure under. And it's sky-high stakes for the people as well, because the question is this going to continue to happen? Because as we've seen, even since the uprising in Baltimore and the charges on those cops, in Madison, Wisconsin, the cop who murdered Tony Robinson was exonerated. So we're continuing to get these messages that these killer cops will be allowed to walk if the system can get away with it. So it's really a question of, are we going to do what's necessary to beat this police terror back? And are people going to get connected to what's necessary to end it once and for all? And that's revolution, nothing less.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to dig into the stakes questions a little bit later in the interview. Yes. But I wanted to actually, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're saying is extremely important in relation to this, obviously. At the same time, I wanted to just touch on something, because there was something that I think really moved a lot of people that I spoke with in the aftermath of the rebellion, and even during the time that was happening, was that the heroism, courage, and defiance of young people, but also what they did actually brought other people into the streets. You know, the fact that at that one baseball game, that all these people who went to see the baseball game actually crossed the police lines to go and find out what people were demonstrating about, what was going on, what was happening, that there was something that really made clear that morally, politically, in every sense, there was a fundamental question of justice must be had and that injustice will not be tolerated. I thought that was that made something very, very, it was not a sloppy message. It was a very clear-cut message. And I thought that was an important aspect of what made Baltimore very different, actually.
Yeah, because see, when you actually looked at what happened and looked at what was behind what happened, you get all of that because, you know, a lot has been said and a lot of slandering of what the young people did in Baltimore, particularly that Monday before the charges were brought down on Friday. But see, what actually happened was high school youth were on the way home from school and the transportation system was shut down by the police. And then the police surrounded them with the intent of delivering a message of who was in charge, you know, and who was going to run the show. And the youth said, uh-uh, because they did not back down in the face of police, you know, with riot gear coming on them. They stood their ground and they resisted this attempt by the police to crush them. And that is actually what unleashed all kinds of things to happen. Other sections of people came out that Monday night. It went on into the night. Then later on that week, college students came out and marched. And see, this was especially significant because there had been days of slander on what happened Monday as senseless violence, people destroying their own neighborhood. So it was really significant that a march mainly of college students that was spearheaded by the Black Student Union and the African Student Union at Johns Hopkins University, one of the elite schools in the country. And it brought together students from Johns Hopkins, from University of Maryland, Baltimore University, as well as the historically Black colleges of Morgan State and Coppin State. But there were students of all nationalities in the streets saying they stood with the people that were fighting for justice. And that showed both the courage and the heart of the young people who had been suffering and their determination to no longer suffer, the mainly Black young people who were doing that, but also the fact that people of other nationalities, people, you know, from better off parts of society, were not going to stand aside and say, oh, well, that's happening to them. That's okay. Do whatever you want. Many of them were stepping into the streets and standing with those young people. And that was very dangerous for the rulers of this country, because one thing that they count on is that they can cover up and justify the brutality and the murder that they're enforcing in the ghettos and barrios in order to keep their setup intact, that they can keep other sections of society in the dark about it and justify it, saying we're doing this to keep you safe. So when other sections of society start saying, no, this ain't what I want to see go down, I'm going to stand with the people that you're suppressing, that is very dangerous for the powers that be. And then it also impacts their global image, because they try to go around the world as like, we represent freedom and democracy. We're the homeland of freedom and democracy. And the scene of armed police in the cities of a major city like Baltimore, National Guard being deployed, police with riot shields going after you, that tears that image apart. So this is a very, very significant development. There's a lot of potential here, but it has to go forward. You know, it can't be that people are like, okay, we've delivered our message. Now let's see what the system is going to do, because the system has already told us what it wants to do and what it will do if it can. And that is to continue unleashing their cops to brutalize and murder people. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take people standing up and saying no more in ever more powerful ways to force them back on that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the high stakes in Baltimore during and after and following the rebellion all the way up to now, and it's something that people really need to be grappling with, all right? Now, Carl, one of the things you say as you're speaking, and what you've said often, you know, you talked earlier about the point of, about the stakes. All right. And I really don't want to short shrift this second segment of the conversation, because it seems people really need to know. If we're talking about, in many ways, Baltimore was different in a certain way. There was a kind of turning point, in a way, whether it's at least at this time, it was kind of a turning point from where things had been and were seeming to go and all. But there was a turning point there, in a way that this really exploded and what happened. And I've told the story before when I was sitting in the Philadelphia airport the day the rebellion happened, and I'm walking down to my gate, and I just see hundreds of people glued to these TV stations in all this and arguing and talking and discussing about what's going on, what happened, what was right, what was wrong. And I wanted to get into this thing about the stakes, because the stakes are extremely important for people to understand. So let's jump into this. Let's talk about what actually are the stakes that are facing the rulers of this country in relation to this.
Yeah, well, I touched on it some. I mean, for them, this terror that the police are unleashed to spread, it's not an optional thing. It's not something that comes from short-sightedness on their part. They actually have a setup that has dispossessed millions and millions of people, especially Black and Latino people, but not only them. And to keep that inequality, that misery and degradation that their system has sunk people into, they require a force that is unleashed, authorized, and has a modus operandi of spreading terror. And Bob Avakian speaks to this in Basics, that the arbitrariness of the terror is a crucial part of it, because it really does come down, and you get this from a lot of Black people, that this could have been me, this could have been my son, this could have been my father, my uncle, my cousin, because that is actually how it goes down. I mean, when you look at it, Freddie Gray is like in the neighborhood early in the morning. It was before 9 o'clock. The cops come, and he realizes this isn't going to go good, and he tries to get out of there. And the cops chase him down, arrest him, injure him horribly. You can see him screaming and barely able to stand up. But then they hogtie him, throw him in the car, and ride him around for 40 minutes. And it would have taken less than 5 minutes to get him to the precinct if that's what they wanted to do. And by the time he gets there, his spine is severed. This is what they did, and it could have happened to anybody. And that's something that they critically have to put down on people in order to keep their setup intact. And they need to be able to do it without facing this kind of resistance, because this resistance exposes that ugly brutality and that wanton murder that they inflict. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is for them. And then you have to look at it. Go ahead.
I was just going to say very quickly, because at the same point, I think the stuff you're saying is extremely important in terms of, look, this isn't optional. This is something that they have to do. This is the fundamental basic role of their police, and their police are never going to be, you know, sort of the sheriff of Mayberry. This is the brute force that is actually the truth around how the system enforces its rule and keeps its rule in place. And when you look at this, I mean, even the contradictions that it sets loose in their own ranks, in terms of, you know, the idea, the struggle over whether you just say, to hell with these people, you know, we're going ahead no matter what, or you start to say, like, you know, Mosby comes out and says, we're going to indict the cops, and starts contradicting what the official story is, and ends up, you know, we read the news this morning that the cops have been indicted, the grand jury agreed, all this other stuff, and, you know, there's this way that they come out that there's sort of there's like a lot of struggling within the ruling class, too, over how to proceed, what's the best way to get to, and that is something that's actually extremely important, I think.
Yeah, that's an important point to bring out, because what this reflects is that a section of the ruling class is like, uh-oh, this is ripping things apart, and we're going to have to take some steps to try to put it back together. And if that means we have to charge a few of our cops for what we've had them out there doing, then that's what we're going to do. While other sections are like, no, you do that and you risk the whole thing coming apart. So we have to keep coming down with the iron fist. And it's not like they've stopped the iron fist overall, because, like I said, they did exonerate several murdering cops in this period, and cops who very clearly murdered people. There's even a video of the cop shooting Tony Robinson in Madison, Wisconsin, that shows that the cop lied about how it happened, because he was like, Tony Robinson was attacking me as I backed down the steps. And there's a video of the cop at the bottom of the steps firing up the steps and into the apartment. And the guy who's supposedly attacking him is still in the apartment, and that's where he actually killed him and then dragged his body down the steps later. So they're still coming with the iron fist, but they feel in the midst of that and in the face of this uprising, they actually have to back up a bit. And it's important that people recognize that charges don't equal justice, because then there has to be a trial, and will prosecutors forget how to prosecute? Will they do a Simi Valley like they did with the cops who were caught on video brutalizing Rodney King back in the 90s and move the case out of Baltimore City to some lily white suburban area where they think they can get a jury that'll let the cops off? You know, there are a lot of different ways they could go about this, and it's going to require people standing up. But the stakes of this go beyond the need to fight through for justice. They include the need to fight through for justice in this case, but they go beyond it. Because I've often said to people, we should live in a society where those entrusted with public security would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. And it would take a revolution to bring that society into being. And the stakes are actually bound up with that. Because you do have people standing up. You have people lifting their heads and going into and digging at, why does this happen again and again? Why do the cops get away with it every time? What is it that we can do to stop that? And that's a period when many more people are open to getting at what's the actual source of this problem and what's the solution. And the stakes include and are bound up with, are they going to get the answers to those questions in this? And that's something that we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are working to bring to people. The Revolution Club has been in Baltimore spreading revolution newspaper, getting posters with pictures of people killed by the cops to dramatize how widespread this problem is and to humanize those victims, and spreading copies of Basics, you know, quotations and short essays by Bob Avakian, bringing to people an understanding of where this problem comes from and what the solution is, and connecting people up and getting them organized to both fight this battle, but also bringing them into a movement for revolution that's aiming at getting rid of this system once and for all. And that's really how the stakes are bound up. People have to fight this through and not get taken in, because one thing that's being put forward is, well, it's the DA, and that's who brought this home. So now what people have to do is get behind the DA. And really what's needed is that message that we're not going to take this has to continue to be delivered, because they're trying to take the case out of Baltimore City, like I said. There have even been articles in the newspaper saying the DA is biased against the police and should recuse herself. And even an article that found it necessary to comment on how the lead prosecutor in the DA's office is a woman who's in a relationship with another woman, as if this has some relevance to the murder of Freddie Gray and the prosecution of that case. In other words, they're trying to leak anything they could that they think might unfavorably cast unfavorable light on the prosecution of these officers. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, people have to continue to stand up, continue to deliver that message, because over the summer, and that's how long this thing is going to go, because they've already said the next court appearance isn't going to be till July. So over the summer, there has to be continued manifestations of people's determination not to see this one go down the way all of the other murders of people by the police in Baltimore and all across the country have gone down. And we're going to be right in the middle of that. In fact, we're going to be holding a forum next week in Baltimore in terms of Baltimore uprising. Our struggle has just begun. Where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. And we're inviting, there are going to be other people speaking as well, but I'm going to be bringing forward that the source of this wanton police terror is the capitalist imperialist system itself and its needs, and that the solution is getting rid of that system once and for all through revolution, and that as part of doing that, we have to continue to stand up, continue to resist, and get organized to carry this fight through.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the high stakes in Baltimore during and after and following the rebellion all the way up to now, and it's something that people really need to be grappling with, all right? Let me ask you this, Carl, because it's related to what you're just saying, and the point that I was thinking a lot about there's a question that's often posed to people about what good are rebellions in the first place? And, you know, even as people are in the aftermath of it, or as people are debating whether or not there should be one, was it right, was it not, there's often that question of, well, if it's not really going to solve the problem for us, what good does a rebellion do? And you've spoken to some of this about, and I think it'd be worth reiterating, you know, what's the most important thing that actually people can learn from Baltimore or from any uprising? And it has to do with actually how you can, it does have to do with the whole, the question of stakes, but also the whole road forward, the whole road out of this. And I'd like to ask you that, starting with the question of what good do rebellions do?
Okay, well, rebellions do a whole lot of good. And I've been around long enough that I could speak to it historically, but I won't do that. Let's just get right down to it. What rebellions show is it shows the potential for people to stand up, to shake off the ways that we're supposed to exist in this society, putting up with whatever it is the system brings down on us. It shows that people can stand up, that they can get the backbone to resist what the system is putting down. Also, through rebelling, that is what put the ugly brutality and murder that the system has been bringing down on people out there for everybody to see. Because normally, people who don't live in the inner cities don't know that this is going down, don't see it. Well, the rebellion put it right out there on Front Street for everybody to see and to feel like they had to take a stand on it. And it made real clear that there was a significant force of people who were not going to take this. The other thing that it did is it brought other people who don't experience this 24/7, having had their eyes open to it, it brought them to stand with the people who have to live their lives under the guns and billy clubs of these brutal murdering cops. So it shows the potential to bring together from different sections of society a force that can not only take on particular injustices, but can out of which can come a force that understands the source of these injustices and can lead a fight to get rid of all of them once and for all. In other words, it's the potential and the potential source for a movement for revolution that can grow and develop and aim to get rid of not only the horror of police murder, mass incarceration, and other ways that blacks and Latinos are being hit with what I call a slow genocide, but it can also go at the vicious attacks coming down on women, the attempts to cut away the right to abortion, the attacks on our immigrant sisters and brothers, the devastation of the environment, all of that. Mm-hmm. So rebellions are very, very important, and that's something that we have seen historically in terms of the 1960s. And a lot of times people say, well, but those rebellions didn't succeed because we're still facing the same oppression, maybe in new forms, but the same oppression. And they're right, but that's because we didn't go beyond rebellion to make revolution. And that's a big part of the stakes right now. Are we going to successfully build off of the uprising, the rebellion that people have sparked off here in Baltimore, and work to bring forward a movement for revolution out of that and everything else that's going on in society that can end these horrors once and for all?
Let me ask you this, Carl, because it's related directly to that. And there's a point that's made in the article, High Stakes in Baltimore. It says, what revolutionaries do in situations like Baltimore can play a big role in making revolution, not just in sort of like, you know, talking about it, but actually play a big role in making revolution. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, because, look, in a situation like this, there are people who want to fight and want to know how to fight politically to take on all these attacks. And in this situation, we can actually organize people for an actual revolution. We can bring forward people who want to run with the Revolution Club. When they see the T-shirts, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, they want to wear those T-shirts as an act of defiance, but also they want to know about this revolution. What's it going to be like? How could it be brought about? And what do we need to do now in order to get in position to do that? We've been taking clips from the dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West, and like, people have been riveted to the screen to watch these clips, and then they say, well, let's watch the whole thing. So we're setting that up with them. There are actual steps that can be taken and also have to be taken in the midst of this, because if we don't take those kinds of steps, if we just limit the struggle to, well, we're just fighting for justice in this particular case, then whether or not people get justice, police murder will continue to go down because the system will still be intact. So if there isn't great leaps forward being made and bringing forward a movement that's aiming to get rid of all of this, then you end up with people having fought very hard, but then still facing the same kind of police terror. And you see the authorities working to bring that about, even where they say, oh, well, this is a big problem. But then their approach to it is, we have to heal the rift between the community and the police. No, we don't have to heal the rift. We have to get the police to stop killing people. You know, that's what the demand is. And that's what people are fighting for. They're not fighting for better relations between the community and police. That's not why people took to the streets. They took to the streets because the police need to stop killing us. And that's going to take massive, powerful, determined resistance to deliver that message throughout society. And like I said, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end it once and for all.
Let me ask you this, Carl. And listen, we have about 3 minutes left, and I want to combine a couple things here. One, you talked about an actual revolution, and it would help, I think, if people understood why you made that qualifier, an actual revolution, you know, and then just give us a hint of what's up now, what's up from here on out.
Okay. Well, I mean, the reason that we talk about an actual revolution is that the term is being picked up and used by different forces, different people and groups and stuff like that. But revolution actually means something, and it means people rising up to get rid of this system, its economic relations, its institutions of repression like the police, the National Guard, and the relations that it enforces among people, the white supremacy, the male supremacy, the suppression of immigrants, and replacing this capitalist imperialist system with another system, a socialist system that's in transition to a full-classless communist society that would have different economic relations, not based on exploitation, different social relations, not based on oppression, and would bring into being institutions that would involve the people who have made the revolution in working to remake all of society and end all of the oppression, all the exploitation, and all of the reactionary ideas characteristic of this capitalist imperialist system. And I try to make that clear to people. Now, in terms of what's next and going forward, it's actually going to be very important that over this, what promises to be a long, hot summer, on this front in particular, the front of police terror, mass incarceration, that people stand up and resist, that they say no more to this and mean it and act on that declaration of no more, taking to the streets. And it has to be built on and knit together as more of a nationwide movement of resistance, one that's not just responding each time they kill us, but is going on the political offensive and taking this fight to a higher level and more on a nationwide level. And people should pay a lot of attention to the websites revcom.us, that's revcom.us, and the website of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which is stopmassincarceration.net, because there are going to be exciting things on this front along the lines of what I was just talking about, and you don't want to miss it.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care. Talk to you again soon, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about the Baltimore Rebellion and the stakes for both the system and for the people and the road ahead. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Welcome back. That was Prince with Baltimore, a song that he composed in honor of and inspired by the Baltimore uprising in April, in late April. On March 3rd, students at the University of California, Santa Cruz launched an action that I think is really, really very significant. It's something that is long needed and long missing on campuses across the country today. And these students stood up against tuition hikes at the UC system and against police murder of black and brown people. And for that, they have been greeted with very, very vicious payback, basically, on a part of the UC system. Joining us to talk about this now are two of the students, two of the Highway 6, and that is Lori Nixon and Ethan Pizzolo. Lori, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
Sure. Ethan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us, Michael.
Sure. Well, why don't we jump into this? Lori, why don't we start with you first. Explain to people who the Highway 6 are.
Well, we are six UC Santa Cruz students ranging from first years all the way up to seniors, and we are six of many students who have been involved in planning and participating in rallies, occupations, marches, all sorts of actions that have been happening this entire year. And we are six of many students who participated in the 96 Hours of Action, which was a week-long protest week against these tuition hikes and against police murder that occurred all over the state of California. Pretty much every UC had actions going on this week, and our action got a lot of attention because we put ourselves out there right in the middle of Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm. And Ethan, tell me this. You put your action out there. What actually was your action on that day?
Well, five other students and I sat down after the fishhook on the on Highway 1 and the 17, and we sat down and linked arms in an act of civil disobedience and sat down on the highway for 5 hours until multiple different police agencies basically got us out of the contraptions linking us together.
Those contraptions were really ingenious. I really like that. I'm always telling people, when people do things like that where they hook their arms between these tubes and, you know, sit down and refuse to move and the police can't move them, you know, I think it's really interesting that people have come up with that kind of tactics. And I'm just babbling on about that myself. But I really like it. So good work.
Well, thank you. Glad to know somebody does.
Sure. Now, as I mentioned, the UC system has hit you very, very hard. I mean, they arrested you on that day, right?
Yes, we were definitely arrested.
Yeah, okay. Now, Lori, why don't we go with you and tell us, what did they do? I mean, what were the charges? And then what were the charges you were facing? And then what happened?
Well, we were initially booked on about five charges, including two felony charges. While we were waiting in jail to either be bailed out or to spend a couple days in there, the ECPD brought us a letter stating that we had been suspended until further notice, and this immediately canceled the housing contracts of at least four of our people that got arrested, canceled their food contracts. All of us were denied our health care, and we still had no idea when we were going to be back in school. So two of us got bailed out that same night, and the four remained in jail for the next couple days, and we were all arraigned on two misdemeanor charges of creating a public nuisance and resisting arrest. So we've gone through most of the pretrial, and we're up to the sentencing phase of, you know, of this action through the criminal court, where we've been sentenced to 3 days in jail. We have a fine, and we're also facing a really high restitution amount from the state of California that we will be fighting. Maybe Ethan can talk more about the UC sanctions that we've been facing.
Yeah, that'd be good. Ethan, can you?
Yeah. So we are facing several different sanctions on the university's part, most of which hint at the accusation that we pose a health and safety threat to the community, to, you know, the campus community and the greater Santa Cruz community. Some of the sanctions say that we prevented access from the campus, although we were 2 miles away from campus. And really, the sanctions that the university is putting on us are they're trying to paint us as these violent students. And obviously, like as Lori mentioned, we got the suspension while we were still in jail. And the nature of the suspension, it's called an interim suspension. The nature of it, it's really only applied in really urgent cases where students all of a sudden, or maybe historically too, but are violent. And usually only when, you know, someone murders someone or something like that is this interim suspension put into place. So the sanctions on the university's part are obviously really extreme, as well as the things they've placed us under a year and a half long suspension. They've also instated a stayed suspension once we return to campus.
What is
basically
that?
Yeah, so the stayed suspension means that if we break any violation of the student code of conduct, then we have the chance to be expelled immediately without any sort of formal hearing process. I mean, what that really means is that we can't partake in political actions or anything like that out of fear for being expelled. And we also have, some of us have 100, some of us have 150 community service hours, as well as a written reflection. But it's important to note that we're all currently appealing all of these and going through several different appeal stages for these sanctions, because obviously they're ludicrous.
Well, let me ask you this. Both of you, I guess all of you, all six of you, pleaded no contest. Can you talk to people about why that happened? Lori, maybe you start and we'll come back to Ethan later.
Sure. You know, it was a difficult decision whether to move forward with going to trial or to plead no contest and take the indicated sentence from the judge. You know, most of us decided that since the DA was pushing for maximum sentence of 18 months in jail, we decided that, you know, it was best to try and preserve our liberty as much as possible while still taking responsibility for what happened. So pleading no contest was definitely a difficult decision to make, but we decided that it was best for us as just as people, as students, you know, as trying to get our lives back together instead of going through this lengthy trial process.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lori Nixon and Ethan Pizzolo, two of the students at UC Santa Cruz who are facing draconian measures that have been enforced against them by the UC system. And they're facing that because they dared to stand up and say no to the assault on students coming from the UC system, as well as to the broader assault, the police murder of black and brown people across the country. Now, Ethan, let's talk with you a little bit about this. This was more than six people taking an act of conscience. It seems like a lot of what I read is that it really did sort of set the campus on fire to a certain extent. Can we talk about what was going on overall?
As Lori stated earlier, there was this 96 hours of action that happened throughout the state at many different college campuses. And, you know, obviously a big part of that was the fight against tuition hikes. But another part of that was the fight against police brutality. And it was really an act of solidarity just to all of the other movements going on nationwide and certain places, you know, like worldwide, and all these places that are rising up saying that they've had enough. The issue of police brutality is not a new one, obviously. It's just gained through like a series of events, like a mass public awareness. But we have students, not just the six of us, but a lot of students, a lot of activists on the Santa Cruz campus have made the connection that police brutality and tuition hikes are products of the failures of the current system that we live in. It's just so clear that the state of California and the nation is putting so much money and time and energy into mass incarceration and into police militarization and these things instead of putting money into teaching people how to function in society.
As I understand it, too, the campus itself, actually, there was a day where the entire campus shut down, right?
Oh, yeah. So at the end of the 96 hours of action, basically, it kind of culminated in this campus shutdown on Thursday. And there's two entrances to the UC Santa Cruz campus. There's a main entrance and then a west entrance. Students at 4:30 a.m. in the morning, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students showed up to these entrances and put their bodies on the line and shut it down all day long until around 7 or 8 p.m. at night. And then even then, students are still there protesting, just not fully shutting it down. So the week of action was highly successful. It's also important to add that I think that our action actually did a lot in terms of putting more cameras and more attention on what was happening that Thursday for the big strike. And it really, I think, also helped decrease the police presence, because police presence is always a thing on campus protests. Even like last year, 22 students got arrested on the west entrance for a peaceful picket with the UAW.
Tell me this, what kind of response have you gotten from the other students on the campus and from the other students at other UCs?
Well, it's been difficult to interact with a lot of people since our suspensions have been keeping us away from campus and have really been keeping us from being involved in what's actually happening on campus. So a lot of the information that we're getting is from people who are our friends and comrades and already support us. And then a lot of the rest of the information we're getting is from the internet. And I'm sure we all know that people are very brave behind their keyboards and will, you know, say reactionary things. We've been threatened with violence from all over the county from people, you know, people saying that we should be in jail, people saying that we should be expelled immediately. And, you know, when I hear these people speak, it makes me really upset, because I don't think people really understand what it means to go to jail and to lose your liberty. I don't think people really understand what it means to commit an act of civil disobedience. A lot of people believe that if you break a law, then you are a criminal and you should go to jail. But, you know, some laws are made to be stood up against. And, you know, in choosing to commit an act of civil disobedience, we've been, you know, dealing with all these consequences. And from the most part, when I run into people downtown or run into people at social gatherings, most people are very supportive and they are very saddened that we can't be there at school with them. They think it's ridiculous that we can't be there. And on top of it, you know, a lot of people have spoken to me that they are now scared to participate in any political actions on campus. The fact that we're being punished so hard is really affecting the rest of the student body, and it is affecting people elsewhere, people don't want to show up at a rally and be faced with a bunch of police just for being there. Our UC police chief at UC Santa Cruz, he was second in command at UC Davis when all those students were pepper sprayed during the Occupy movement. So people are really scared that there's now going to be like an intense police response to peaceful political protesting. You know, students don't even want to publish art pieces that are critical of the university at this point. So the fact that we're being punished so severely is having a very negative effect on the political organizing and the political pulse of our fellow students.
Tell me this, is it also true, though, that you're receiving some kind of positive response from the students themselves as well as from other students in the UC system? When I saw what you guys did, one of the things that really struck me was this was the kind of thing that's needed across the country, in campuses across the country. Have you heard from other campuses? Have you heard?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, where a lot of us are plugged in with student organizers across the state. And, you know, there's been solidarity actions that happened at UC Santa Barbara. Berkeley is constantly having actions, taking over Spell Hall, confronting Chancellor Dirks whenever they had the moment. I just heard they ran into him and were, you know, tossing packets of Top Ramen at him to, you know, to really hammer home that students are struggling. Students and their families are struggling. So there's definitely been a positive, supportive response. But specifically at our campus, it's mostly underground. People are not really coming forward yet because they're waiting to see what happens with our suspensions. But there definitely is a positive response. People are doing work. People are still out there organizing and talking to people and really keeping this conversation going, because when it comes down to it, that's what civil disobedience is about, to bring attention and to interrupt the daily flow so that people start talking about it and start thinking about it.
Yeah, I also would like to add that The Atlantic just came out with an article called The Renaissance of Student Activism, and it's talking directly about all of the actions students across the nation are taking. And although a lot of the actions that are taking aren't directly solidarity with us or any of that, but they're all about these same really central, deep issues that we're all fighting against. And so in a way, the whole nation is rallying together. The whole nation students are rallying together right now around the numerous injustices that the nation that we live in right now is perpetuating on a daily basis. So I feel the support nationwide.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Laurie Nixon and Ethan Pizzolo, two of the students at UC Santa Cruz who are facing draconian measures that have been enforced against them by the UC system. And they're facing that because they dared to stand up and say no, no to the assault on students coming from the UC system, as well as to the broader assault, the police murder of black and brown people across the country. Tell me something else. I know I read somewhere where there was some kind of online thing or some kind of, I don't know whether it was a chat board, it was whatever it was, that pulled together 4,000 people who I guess you don't know who they are, but they're demanding that you be not only suspended, but basically kicked out of school altogether, right?
Yes, that did happen. That was almost pretty much immediately when we got arrested. That petition got put up on change.org. And, you know, the issues with those kind of petitions is we don't really know who's signing it. We don't really know if they're a Santa Cruz community member. And, you know, it was from a place reacting from frustration and anger and inconvenience. You know, I get in a traffic jam and I'm immediately just like, what is going on? You know, and then you find out that it's like, if there's not an accident, that it's, you know, six people making a political statement. Yeah, people are going to be angry about that. But I think now that the dust is starting to settle and people are really starting to think about these issues in a larger context and realize that they're actually connected to them on a daily basis. You know, police brutality is something that affects all of us. Tuition hikes in public education affect all of us. And I think when people are able to step out of their daily routine and realize that traffic is not as important as people dying and people struggling in debt, I think that's where the conversation keeps going. But if people stop the conversation at this petition to have us expelled, they just stop it there, then they're not really, you know, we're not really getting into a deeper understanding of what's happening and why the action occurred.
I keep thinking about this point about what's needed on the campus today and how what you guys did at UC Santa Cruz was so important in terms of what it was saying, but also what it said nationally, what it said around the world, that students in the U.S. are not principally sort of just dead and not interested in the rest of the world. And one of the things that I thought, Laurie, that you were talking about that's really very interesting to me is the idea that what you've gone up against with people has been this thing of this came into conflict with their self-interest. You know, this came into conflict with their convenience. And instead of shying away from that, it seems that you folks have actually decided that you'll go up right up into the face of that and say, look, this is something that was really needed. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would love to speak to that. I think that the type of society that we live in actively produces a real sense of individualism in everyone. It's kind of everything for myself, you know, and it's really hard to get out of the idea that you're constantly working for yourself, because that's just what you need to do to survive in this society, in this capitalist society. You need to focus on increasing your profit so that you can survive. And so I think what we did basically directly went against that sort of individualism by saying, like, no, like, you need to listen to this, and, like, we need to stand together and kind of, like, basically sacrifice a little bit of the privileges that come from, you know, being able to be an individual and stand together and fight as a whole. Yeah.
I definitely think this action and any kind of action that, you know, disrupts business as usual really just points to larger failures in the system. You know, why are we spending hours of our week and hours of our day in a car on a freeway, you know, burning through all this gas, putting more money into our cars, putting more money into our car repairs? Why do parents have to leave their children every single day to go to work to make money for other people? Why can we only see our doctors once every 2 months? What's really going on there that's keeping us from looking at these larger problems in the system?
Now, let me ask you this. The ACLU has gotten involved in this as well, right?
Yeah, so the ACLU immediately reached out to us and wrote a couple letters of solidarity and support directly addressed to the university. And they just pointed out the constitutional violations. There's been, you know, due process violations, and they prevented us from our right to legal counsel, and not giving us adequate due process, obviously, you know, by telling us that we were suspended in jail without ever allowing for a formal hearing to decide that. So the ACLU has been a big help in pointing out very clearly that the university is in the wrong here.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Laurie Nixon and Ethan Pizzolo, two of the students at UC Santa Cruz who are facing draconian measures that have been enforced against them by the UC system. And they're facing that because they dared to stand up and say no. No to the assault on students coming from the UC system, as well as to the broader assault, the police murder of Black and brown people across the country. Now, this is a question for both of you, and it's sort of built around the statement that, Ethan, that you gave, but I'd like to hear Laurie speak on this as well. You made the statement that you said, "I'm standing before you today to tell you that I'm not a criminal, but there are real criminals in this world, real acts against our humanity that occur every day." Let's talk about that a minute.
Yeah, sure. So it's very clear at this point that the media and the university and the state in general is portraying us as criminals, and they're conveying it in a way to the general public that the public thinks of us as criminals too, and simply because we broke a law. And there's kind of a historical context for that, because people have been breaking laws for the sake of humanity for a long time, and that's what this nation has been founded on, is acts of protest and acts of civil disobedience to make our society better. So what I really meant by that was that we're not the criminals, and that it's very intentional that the university and the media and the state is portraying us as such, because they're hiding the fact that they're the real criminals, that they're the ones that are perpetuating all of these things, all of these awful, atrocious things. And I was just really trying to point out that people are being fed this representation of activists that is a sham, and that, like, that they're trying to make it seem like we don't care about the community. None of us would sacrifice our education, sacrifice our house, like, sacrifice food if we didn't, like, really deeply care about the community. And so I think that's really, really important that people understand that, like, we care so much, and that's why we decided to do that. Mm-hmm. And the university and the state and the media are trying to represent us in a different light.
Laurie, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, criminals, people like that, are not just born out of nothing. You know, when we're seeing Baltimore uprising right now, that's coming from years and years of policies that have forced people into situations where they must now become criminal, quote unquote criminals, just in order to survive. And for me specifically, I've gone through a lot in my life where, you know, it's pushed me to this point where, can I really just continue on with my life and not speak up about the atrocities that are being committed? I lost my house and I was laid off because of budget cuts to public education, because so much money is going into police and prisons instead of our education system. So it gets to a certain point where it's like, you have to act or you're not going to be able to survive anymore. And once you act, then you're labeled as a criminal. But really, you're pushed through all these different factors in our society that are really trying to keep people down. So when you're reacting to the power structures, that's when you become a criminal in the eyes of the state. And that's really being used as a way for our other people, for, you know, for our fellow students and for our fellow community members. The state labeling as such is just making it okay for everybody else to label us that way, and really just stop the conversation and stop the critical thinking about what actually went into this action and why this action occurred.
All right. Now, one final question, and I'm not sure, I guess we'll say, Lori, we'll ask you to answer this. What is it that people can do? Where do things stand, and where are they going, and what can people do?
Well, there's always conversation. There's so much reading. There's so many articles. There's so many things out there. So really just get involved in the issues and really understand the back history and the context of not only our, you know, freeway action, but of police brutality, of public education. Why is so much money being diverted from, you know, from public education? How did that occur? What actions had to happen for that to take place? So I think really just getting really involved in the issues. You know, for us specifically, we're in the middle of a huge legal battle. We're setting the stage right now to file a civil suit against the university for our constitutional violations of our due process, right to counsel, right to evidence, all these things. So we're setting the stage for that, and we're really trying to, you know, mix with our community. We do have a Facebook page set up, so if people are interested in reaching out to us, I can definitely share that information.
And Ethan, you have anything more to add to that?
I'm going to call out to students and to community members, specifically in Santa Cruz, but really around the world, that we know what goes on in our country, and we know the injustices that are going on. And it's really time. We've come to the crossroads right now, and all the students and all the people in these cities are rising up and taking a stand now, because it's pivotal that we all stand up right now and tell the government and tell the CEOs running the government that we've had enough and that we need things to change. So I just want to call out and say that it's time to stand up. And you're so right, Michael. We need everyone to do things like we did on that highway.
Exactly. All right. Ethan, Lori, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Okay. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care now. All right. We have just been talking with Lori Nixon and Ethan Pizzolo from the Highway 6 up in Santa Cruz. Six students who on March 3rd blocked a crucial intersection on Highway 1 and shut it down for a number of hours. And they were doing it to protest tuition hikes and to stand up against police murder, police brutality against black and brown people. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix, Ethan Pizzolo, and Lori Nixon. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Bomb the Tracks from Chucky Weiss, just because it seems to be so fitting. All right, talk to you again next week.
Bomb the tracks, Jack. You should have stopped the train.